Last time we were looking into the cellular network basics, and that's just how do you arrange for global coverage. And so the idea is that you arrange your base stations in some sort of regular fashion, and then you make use of the fading property to be able to reuse channels. So a cell refers to the coverage of a base station, and you arrange the cells into multi-cell clusters, and the cluster shares out the channels amongst the individual cells. So we need the clusters then to tessellate, so we need to, again, cover everything. We noted that then the reuse distance to cell radius determines what we call the signal interference ratio, so how much interference was being provided by cells using the same channels. And so if you define this ratio of reuse distance to cell radius, then it was a geometric exercise to decide what the cell clusters had to look like. Okay. So, yeah, sort of working back, that meant that your SIR determines, yeah, again, this pattern of cells. Moving beyond that, then, we said that you had a certain number of channels to share out along the cluster, and so the number of channels any cell got had a bearing on how many users could be supported within the cell. And we looked at Erlang's theorem to give some sort of feel for that. So I left with you with a question, which I have a sneaking suspicion I probably forgot to post, but I need to be on slideshow. And so here we determine our signal to interference ratio. This is something that we require. We have constraints on how the power is dropping the distance. And again, that depends on terrain and whatever, but we're just going to be picking numbers between 2 and 5 usually. And there's a number of channels to share out. So the question, the first question is how many channels will we have available to us if we set up either an omnidirectional or a sectorized system? And then beyond channels, we can ask how many users are going to be supported by those channels for each of the different systems. Okay. And so, part two, we say, well, we can tolerate up to 2% loss, so up to 2% of users get disappointed. But then we ask, how many users can we have in the system? That's dependent, again, on the number of channels available. Okay, and then finally, we can, think about sort of what pros and cons of each of the systems is. Okay. So the first part is fairly straightforward. Our signal to interference ratio translated out of decibels is equal to 1 over k, 3n to the gamma over 2. And here gamma again is 4. Okay. K is the number of interfering cells, and that's, again, the whole reason we do sectorization is to reduce the number of interfering cells. So you start out with 6 interfering cells from the directional antennas, 2 if you use 3 antennas, and only 1 if you use 6 antennas. Okay. So all you need to do there is plug in the numbers and solve for n. That's easy enough. And so you'll get various values for n. Obviously, n needs to be an integer. You can't have half a cell, so you have to do the whole units. And again, you have to find I and j, such as I squared plus ij plus j squared equals n. Okay, so we get 3 different values for n, depending on, again, how many antennas we're using. And then we divide up our channels according to how many cells we get. Okay, so that's just 126 channels divided by n gives us channels per cell. And then if we're using a sectorized system, again, the sectors, the channels aren't shared amongst sectors, so we have to further allocate the cells' channels to each sector in turn. So you have 31 channels per cell, but you have 3 sectors per cell, so three sectors per cell, that gives you 10 channels per sector. Similarly, you have 42 channels per cell, but six sectors, so you get 7 channels per sector. So, if we know, sort of again, on average, how the customers are using the channels, so they're only using them for a certain percentage of the time, essentially, then, and we can tolerate some blocking, some loss, then we can determine how many users we can have per sector, or what the load, what the available load is per sector. So here, what we've done is just again, we can tolerate 2% blocking or loss, and so if you look up in your airline tables, that will give you a certain load per number of channels available. So, again, for the omnidirectional, we have 18 channels. For the sectorized systems, we have to look at the channels per sector. So we have 10 and 7, respectively. And so that's going to give you a load expressed in airlines of 11, 5, and 2.9, respectively. But now, you have more sectors per cell, so if you want to look at how much traffic you can bear per cell, you have to multiply by the number of sectors. So you have 3 sectors here, so you multiply your 5 by 3. You have 6 sectors here, multiply your load by 6. Okay, so what we see is that we have achieved some improvements by using our sectorized systems, but as we mentioned before, there are some drawbacks to using sectorization as well. Okay, and so the main drawbacks again are that you need more equipment for sectorizations and more antennas. And you'll have, if your traffic is not evenly distributed within the cell, you're going to lose some of the advantages of sectorization, because again, you'll have channels available but which can't be used by specific users. And finally, not here, but you also have more chances of handover. Okay, so if you're moving around within the cell, you are still having to perform handover. The user is having to change the channel on which they're working. And as we see today, it's non-trivial to sort of manage the user connectivity. Okay, so that problem does sort of sum up what we looked at last week. And for the next couple of lectures, we're going to look at the implementation detail. Well, I say details, but some bit of details about the implementation of cellular networks. So this is, we've talked about some of the just basic philosophies behind or principles, but now how do you actually make one work? And the answer is, it's very, very complicated. Does anybody here work for a telco at all? Nope, nobody's. So a lot of times we get at least one or two people who are working for telcos, and it's a lot of acronyms, a lot of detail. And obviously, here we're not going to have time to sort of delve into gory detail about any particular aspect, but we'll sort of hit a few highlights that will hopefully give you a feel for what it takes to actually implement one of these networks. So I've split it up into basically voice connectivity, which is exemplified by GSM, and then we'll do data connectivity next week. And so I've posted a paper on the sort of highlights of GSM, and it sort of gives you, again, it's a reasonably decent summary. If you go to the library, you can find sort of rows of books which will sort of go into more detail about the various aspects, but again, hopefully we'll just end up with some view of sort of what's involved. Okay, So what we'll do is, well, we'll start by, you know, saying a few words about evolution, which will hopefully motivate why we're starting sort of back in the dark ages of, you know, voice-connected cellular networks. And then we'll look at details about GSM as the key voice-connected implementation, voice connectivity implementation. And so again, we'll look at the basic architecture, what are the components, the radio link aspects for all of these. Obviously, a critical component is just that end link between user and network. And then, again, we'll say a little bit about managing the connectivity and managing the network to support not just one end link, but calls from end to end. Okay, so relative to telephony networks, cellular networks are reasonably new
phenomenon, and they arose in the 70s, and the first versions of cellular networks were designed to carry analog voice traffic. Okay, so in your actual voice, the signal was sent as an analog signal. Okay. So one of the first implementation was the Bell Labs Advanced Mobile Phone System AMPS. And that was demonstrated in Chicago and went into operation in 1978. These cellular systems were standardized in the early 80s. Okay. The problem with the 1G standardization is that everybody came up with their own standardization. So there were some sort of pockets of connectivity, but you certainly couldn't move from country to country and actually expect your phone to work. And so you see, even within Europe, were multiple standards. And certainly beyond that. Yeah. Okay. So the upshot of that was that, there was a limited applicability to all these of this equipment, so it was limited to kind of sort of fixed regions. Again, since the markets were fairly small, then it was hard to sort of build competition, and so they're fairly expensive. Okay. In addition, the analog transmission meant that there was quite low capacity. You could only send a very small number of signals in a given area. Okay. Nonetheless, their popularity did grow, and by the early 90s, you would have had tens of millions of users. So the first our major evolutionary step or improvement was to move from analog to digital signals. And we're still talking about voice connectivity. So you're talking about digitizing your voice signal. Okay. This did allow for the support of data services now, since you have, you know, one bit is much the same as another bit. And data services definitely took a back seat to voice transmission, but we were able to much increase our system capacity by digitizing our voice signal. There were still a lot of standards floating about, but eventually GSM emerged as sort of the de facto global standard. Okay. And hence that's what we'll be talking about today. The U.S. held out with TDMA and CDMA systems, and so maybe one of the interesting bits about that is it was the first to move away from fairly basic signaling to code division multiple access of spread spectrum signaling. Okay. So, GSM dominates your 2G world. It was about its peak. It was sort of a huge percentage of the global market. And one possible argument for still talking about it is that it's actually still prevalent in the developing world. It's relatively inexpensive. It's reliable. It still actually does exist. Here, it exists, but sort of more in a repurposed fashion. So it actually provides non telephone related services even here. It provides some wireless connectivity for more device-oriented data. Okay, so like alarm systems, if you want a wireless monitored alarm system, frequently they're GSM-based. Okay, so it still exists, but again, in Europe, in North America, in a lot of Asia, not so much. So the use of GSM sort of broadly made roaming possible, although it was still not the only standard. So typically if phones would, if they wanted to roam, would have sort of multiple radio components to allow for different standards. Okay, so 3G, the goal of 3G was essentially to give data, sort of put data on at least an equal footing with voice, not dominant over voice. And a lot of the 3G systems were evolutionary steps from the 2G systems. Okay. So GSM evolved into UMTS, CDMA,
Along evolved into, I think that did say CDMA Advanced, another CDMA-based system, but there were evolutionary steps. There were sort of intermediate steps where the 2G system were basically enhanced, and then 3G, the idea was to come up with sort of new spectrum, new air interfaces, and sort of make a newer start at the problem. Okay. So, again, the goals were to support database traffic, so packet switch traffic, do it in today looks like it's painfully slow rate, but at the time looked pretty good. And again, to sort of come to some negotiated settlement about usage so that we could have more worldwide standards. Okay. So, there were a number of bridging standards which sort of were moving towards this idea of good quality data support, but building on top of the existing standards. So again, in Europe, you had things like GPRS and EDGE, and we'll see more about the details of those. But again, they added packet services to GSM, and CDMA1 moves to CDMA2000. So again, supporting packet services. This is now history, obviously, since we're talking 4G. We have 4G, and we're talking about 5G now. But it's sort of instructive in that it shows that not all the issues to do with these things are technical issues, but 3G was in Europe and the US, 3G was very slow to be rolled out. And one of the reasons was that the licenses were auctioned and the phone companies paid a lot for these licenses. Having paid a lot for the licenses, they just didn't have the cash to actually develop the systems to use the licenses. So, again, it's some sort of salutary lesson in that. But other systems which use different licensing techniques were much, other countries that use different licensing techniques were much quicker to roll out their 3G systems. Okay, so what was 3G? Well, first of all, we had now an international body to oversee the specification, so we had ITU defined IMT 2000, which specified the requirements for our 3G systems. So we saw that, again, under good conditions, we could get up to 2 megabits per second data rate. If we're moving, that data rate dropped. And there was a requirement for global mobility. And this did not mean that everybody had to use the same radio technology, but the back end then had to be interchangeable, so you can interface with back ends. Again, if phones wanted to move from country to country to country, frequently they needed multiple radio components to do that. It supported both circuit and packet switching, and then also supported the up-and-coming then multimedia and real-time services. So again, these what we'll see in the UMTS was these were given some special consideration. Now with 4G, there's a way back into data in general. Excuse me. Okay. So again, the ITU defined the standards, and again, the goal of that was just to ensure interoperability. And we still ended up with a couple of competing standards. In Europe, we had three GPP proposing the UMTS standard. And in the U.S., we had 3GPP2, or sort of, I should say, North America, 3GPP2. Proposed the CDMA 2000 standard. So we still didn't get down to one standard, but the main difference between those was, again, the area interface, which you could work with. Okay. 4G is more of the same. Again, ITU defined the requirements in the IMT Advanced Standard, and 3GPP and 3GPP2 went along with multiple standards, but at some point, you know, 3GPP2 was based on the CDMA. At some point, they gave up and rolled into the LTE world. So at long last, we have actually arrived at a single standard, the LTE standard. Okay. And so LTE Advanced is the 4G standard. 5G has not been defined yet, and there's a number of ideas about what 5G actually is or might be. I think what everybody agrees is that it's just going to be even higher data rates. Okay. And so again, we can view the progression through these standards as sort of an evolutionary process. Yeah. And, you know, like evolution, at some point you do actually jettison chunks of what you used to do and change, but we'll see how which bits change at any given point. Okay. So, the first thing we're going to look at is what are the basic components of our GSM system and how do these components interact with each other and what do you do? How do you essentially make a phone call using these components? And after that, we'll see. So again, yeah. Delve into the details of the radio links and channel allocation.
Okay. So, again, the goal of GSM was to provide mobile digital voice connectivity. And since it was digital, again, you could support data transmission as well, but this was done pretty much on a modem-like basis and just took your voice channel and you sent your data over it, but you still created the channels. Okay. Again, what the voice connectivity means is that we have connection-oriented circuit-switched systems. So you create a circuit, you reserve the resources, and you transmit along that circuit. Okay. So you said it's the dominant standard, but not the only one. It's very, very complex, and there are 6,000 pages to the GSM standard. Again, this is in line with sort of telephony systems overall. Okay. They're large, complex systems. So obviously all we're doing is sort of hitting a few highlights. So, again, like all telephony systems, there's a huge number of acronyms associated with them. So hopefully we'll try and keep it as low as possible, but it is alphabet soup. And just wait till we get, but these are fairly reasonable, they make sense, just wait till we get to the data channels and try and keep track of all that. Okay, so there's three main components to our mobile system. So we have the base station subsystem, and this is, again, responsible for that end link, so the wireless link between users and the cellular system. And we'll go into detail later. And so that's managing sort of this point-to-point connectivity. But again, what we're trying to do with GSM is create circuit switched calls. So we somehow have to get back to the telephone network, and so the switching subsystem manages all of that connectivity. Okay. And again, we'll go into the details of the components later. So from a user perspective, you have to connect with a base station. The base station is managed by SBSC, which also forwards the user data back into the switching subsystem, which then connect eventually to the public telephone system. It's also, again, possible to send data, so you can connect back to a data network as well. Okay, so we'll go into a few details about what each of the subsystems does. But it's useful to sort of get some think about the coverage area as well, and who manages
for communication within coverage areas. So obviously, if we start small, we have a cell, and that's covered by a base station. Beyond that, we have what's called a location area. It's called a location area because it's associated with, if you're calling for paging. So it's essentially how many base stations do we have to page in order to locate a user as they're moving through the system. And so the location of the user is tracked to the location area, but not, again, to the base station, to an exact base station. And MSC, then, so the switching center, will manage a number of location areas which have a number of BSCs associated with them. And so beyond that, again, you have the area that is covered by a single operator, as we call that, the public land mobile area. And in this case, here, that would be the entire country, for instance. Okay. So, users obviously are moving from cell to cell to cell. They then possibly move to a location area, into a new location area that has to be tracked. And again, possibly they move from the coverage of one MSC to a new MSC. Again, that will have to be tracked. So, different components of the system talk to each other or don't. The user does not talk directly to the MSC, for instance. Interfaces are used to define the communication between any given system. And so, again, if we want to trace a connection between our mobile user out to the telephone network, then the signal is going to have to transfer over a number of these interfaces, not all of which are air, a lot of which are actually wired. Okay, so you connect to your base station. Then the base station connects to the BSC, the BSC connects to the MSC. MSCs might have to coordinate amongst themselves. Eventually the MSC connects to a gateway, and the gateway connects out to the telephone network. Okay, and not in no particular order, again, some of the interfaces and their functionality. So the A interface is between the MSC, the BSC, and the MSC, and this deals with mainly the network and switching aspects. So it's managing the links and controlling sort of the high-level aspects of the communication, like encryption and sort of, again, overall connection management. The AIS interface is between the BSC and the BTS, and that's going to manage all of the channel information, so allocating channels to the base stations and controlling the parameters of the radio transmission, so monitoring conditions, and so the BSC is sort of brains, and it's monitoring the conditions, and based on that, it's doing deciding what coding level you need, what power control you need, etc. Okay, the UM interface is the interface between with the user, and so again, it's going to set which what channels the user and the base station communicate over. Then the E interface is between MFCs and manages handovers. The C interface will connect to the PSTN. Okay. Okay. So now if we look at the various components of the system. So we start with our base stations. So we have a base station subsystem, and this comprises of a number of BSCs connected to a number of base stations. The BSC is managing the base stations and managing the physical links that will occur and then communicating back to the MSC. So it's responsible for handover, cell configuration, the radio frequencies and power levels within the base stations. A single MSC will connect to a number of BSCs, so we'll manage a number of BSCs. The base stations themselves, obviously, are just communicating, or are there to communicate with the mobile users, and then forward information back to the BSC and into the system. So you have basic signal transmission and reception, and fairly simple control functions. Again, speech coding. So the type of encoding used for the signal. Okay, so there's again one BTS per cell. There's multiple BTSs and multiple cells associated with one BSC, and then multiple BSCs or the base station subsystems associated with one MSC.
Okay, and that manages, again, the link between the user and the cellular network proper, over a wireless link. So the switching system subsystem then
manages the connectivity between the user and the network proper. And so allows for call connectivity, again, between multiple users. The main element of the switching subsystem is the MSC, the mobile switching controller. And this is used for user connectivity. So it'll manage sort of the user access to the network at all, and then user call setup. It interfaces the user call, again, between the wireless link and then the network proper, or the gateway. And it can manage, again, the resources within the base station subsystem.
Okay. So beyond the MSC, or
supporting the MSC, I should say, are a number of databases. And the databases are there to hold information about the users that is necessary to, again, manage user access to the network. So the home location register stores information about users, permanent information about users. Their service profiles, so what the service they're entitled to within the network, anything about authentication. Let's see the permanent information about the networks. And it will also store a small amount of information about the user's current state within the network. Okay. And in particular, it stores the location of the visitor location register. And the visitor location register tracks where the user is at the moment. So it has information about sort of the user's current status within the network. And all we have in the home location register is a way of finding out that information. So our visitor location register is storing temporary information about the subscribers in the MSC's region. So the home location register stores everybody who's entitled to connection to the network. The visitor location register is just those who are currently connected in a specific region. The authentication center is used to verify user identity, and the equipment identification register could potentially stores information about the equipment and could be potentially used to manage stolen equipment. And sometimes these two are merged. Okay, so again, the main component is the MSC, and that has to use the various databases to manage connectivity. We also have a few other components. We have the message exchange center, and that manages sort of messaging. So if you want to, if you want to leave any type of message, that would be managed through the MXC. The mobile service node handles intelligent services, so things like call forwarding. And more significant, so the MSC is also responsible for forwarding connections out to either data networks or public telephone networks. Okay.
Okay. So again, your BSC, it's just essentially providing the resources for a connection. The MSC is what's managing sort of connections or enabling connections to be made end to end. Okay, the Operation Maintenance Center is just sort of global network management issues. So monitoring the condition of the network and failure recovery, managing the databases, and also billing. Billing's probably actually the most important function that that would happen. So those are things that are sort of not directly linked to individual users. Okay. So, if we look at a few examples now, we'll look at various functions and see in how we have to move through various components of the network. So, if we start with accessing the network, again, the user is going to have to find the network, then is going to have to convince the network that they have a right to access that network. Okay. So on the user end, we have SIM cards, and they store the user information and the user identity. The IMSI identity is what is used by the home location register to associate users with their information, and so we have the user information, like the subscriber services, and then when we are able to connect to home location register, it will store, again, the visitor location register so that the user can be found. So when the phone is powered on, it searches for the closest base station and makes contact. Again, we'll see more detail how that works later, but we just assume they can do that. Then, once that contact is made, the current location of the phone can be entered into the or tracked by the visitor location register, and again back to the home location register. We'll have an entry as to what visitor location register is being used, and that's managed by the BLR, which will send information to the HLR. So the DLR has to, again, share its identity with the HLR, and then it gets a copy of the SIM records and stores the location of the user. Okay. So, if we're now receiving calls, then the call will enter in through the GMSC, so entering through our gateway. GMSC then has to determine the location of the receiving phone, and so again the home location register will know where the visitor location register and the relevant MSC is. The home location register might have additional information such as call forwarding. Or that the user is not currently in the network, but assuming we have a standing case where the user is connected to the network, then the DLR pins down as far as possible the location of that connection. So an MSRN, a temporary number, is issued, and this is used to identify the user and make the connection between the gateway and the user. So this allows the routing phones to the visiting MSC. So wherever, the one associated with the visitor location register. The visiting MSC uses the MSRN to find the phone's records, including location of one or more PLCs, and we can then use paging to find actually pin down the user within the paging area. Okay. Assuming paging works, the phone can respond, and that information is returned to the MSC. And then links, again, a circuit is set up between the MSC is used to set up a circuit between the base station and the MSC, and further on. And when, sorry, actually, but you forward the call, and then if the user picks up, then you can set up your circuit.
And again, the circuit is going all the way from the user to the caller.
Okay. And the path goes from the BTS to the BSC to the MSC to the gateway. Okay. So making calls,
again, it's the MSC that's going to be responsible for attempting to make the call. The mobile signal has to transmit its request through the base station. The base station then attempts to forward the request to the MSC. Okay. If the MSC sort of is, acknowledges the user's right to make that call, then the MSC establishes a connection with the user and requests the call number be sent to the MSC. Once the MSC has the call number, it can go out through the gateway to, again, find the callee. Okay, and if the callee is another mobile user, then at the other end you're going to have all the stuff that we just talked about before.
Okay, so again, the main point is just that in order to establish our connectivity, we're having to go through these multiple elements within the system. Okay, with the ultimate goal, again, of establishing a circuit, so a channel over which we then just send our voice data. Okay.
So, we're going to look at some of the details. Well, we're going to look at two sort of aspects of setting up this connection. The first is looking at the radio link. So, what does that connection look like between the mobile user and the base station? Then we're going to look at, again, managing that connection, not just over this first link, but back through the network.
And so, at first glance, the channels
for GSM look relatively straightforward. And so the physical aspects are fairly easy. We have a time and frequency division multiple access scheme. And so our frequencies are divided up into channels, and we have overall, our spectrum is 225 megahertz wide bands, and these bands are divided up into 200 kilohertz channels, so we have 124 sub-channels along these. We define repair our channels now in an uplink and a downlink direction. Okay. And so a channel will have an uplink component in the first band and then a downlink component in the second band. Further, we use time division multiple access, and that means that we're splitting our signal for our signaling according to time slots, and we have eight. I think we split it into eight slots. That means you transmit sort of 1 to 8, and then circle around again and transmit 1 to 8, or well, 0 to 7 again. So what a user is going to be allocated, more or less, is a carrier frequency plus times, or a pair of carrier frequencies plus time slots. So, this pairing of time slots and frequencies gives us what are called physical channels. So they're essentially the basic building blocks over which we can send our information. And again, we've arranged physical channels in pairs. So we have uplink and downlink direction offset by 45 megahertz, so it's the same offset. And then again, uplink and downlink receive different time slots. So the downlink direction is delayed by 3 relative to the uplink. What this means is that you're never sending and receiving at the same time, and that just makes the transceiving easier.
Okay. So that gives you 8 physical channels per carrier frequency, 1 for each time slot. And now the question becomes, well, what are we transmitting on each of these time slots? Okay. And we have to use these channels to do a lot of different things. We're transmitting our speech, our data, but we're also having to transmit all of our signaling information, so all our control information. That all has to go over these same physical slots. So the question becomes, how do you know what's being transmitted at any given time? This is... similar to, well, this is, this idea is from, you know, telephony world, where, again, where certain of the time slots were devoted to control information. So some of the time slots would be data, some of them would be control. What happens here is, in the physical, in wired telephony, there's, you know, I'm not saying it's simple, but there's a lot less things going on, so you don't need quite as much control signaling. Here, we have a lot more signaling going on,
And so how we allocate those time slots becomes more complex. So none of our carrier time slot combinations, none of our physical channels have any exclusive use within GSM, but they're shared out and they do different things at different times. And the problem is that we have to keep track of what they're doing, or the system, the system has to keep track of what they're doing at any given time. So what we have is different messages being transmitted on the physical channels at different times, and we refer to a message, this type of message being transmitted on the channel, as a logical channel. So it's telling you now what the message, what the type of message is, and what type of information you're going to view on this logical channel. So the logical channel performs a specific task, and again, everybody needs to know what task is being performed at what time. And so if we look at this, again, we have different carrier frequencies, so we can fix one frequency, and then on that frequency, we've got our 8 time slots. So this is what's being transmitted on the frequency at any given time. And so if you look, if you just pull out a given time slot, that gives you your physical channel. Okay. Now, our logical channel says that at different points in time, different things are going on that physical channel. Okay. So at time n, here we're transmitting data. We'll go into that later. Time n plus 1, we're transmitting data. Time n plus 2, now we're actually sending some control information. And, of course, the user needs to know which of these is happening. So what we're going to do is we're going to essentially group together a number of these time slots. So we can take n to n plus x. And then based on, and so that will define a frame. And then based on your position within the frame, you're going to know what's going on. Okay. So based on the position within the frame, you know what your logical channel is. Yes?
I'm not sure I understood. These time slots are divided between also the users, like two users can have the same carrier frequency and shared time slots, or?
Well, this is again a circuit switch system, so the user will be allocated channels. Okay. Once it's allocated the channel, it holds that channel for the duration.
Yeah.
So no, actually, so if it's given one of these slots, then it's going to hold it, and nobody else will be using it while it holds it.
Okay. But like, how is it synchronized between different users all the time?
The system, the cellular system, controls everything.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is more or less. I mean, obviously, there's the users have to get access, and so on access channels, yeah, you can have two users competing, colliding, not getting access. Once you have access, everything is controlled by the system. The system is allocated those resources. Nobody else is going to use them. So, yeah, I guess that's where you were getting at was, the users need to get access to the system, and that is sort of a competitive basis. It is that you can potentially have collisions at that point. But once they get in and make their request, the system allocates them resources, and there's no more contention.
And does each user dedicate a channel?
Eventually, yeah, each user will get
okay.
a channel.
So there's kind of a max of 8 that users can simultaneously.
But we have different frequencies. No, we have different frequencies as well. So it's not the well. You wouldn't even get 8 users because again, they're stealing things for control as well.
Yeah.
But again, you have more frequencies available to you. Okay. So, if we return to our idea of trying to make a connection, then, as we've seen, the base station is going to have to be transmitting some sort of beacon signal. And that's going to happen in a particular time slot. So there's a specific frequency and time slot, in this case, time slot 0, on which the base station is broadcasting its information. So that's the downlink direction. So the uplink direction is then a frequency shift of 45 degrees up. And the mobile station can signal along that uplink channel now that it needs to set up a call. There's then going to be a whole bunch of signaling, which we'll return to later, which is used to allocate channels. Specific channels to the user, and so again the signaling will be done again in this 0 time slot, and potentially, yeah, and that's a sort of an example, but more slots can be allocated for larger cells with sort of more channels and more information. Okay. So there's 4 main types of channels. We have our traffic channels, and those are the data channels, as the ones along which the user is sending data. Okay. You have broadcast channels. So, as you would expect, they're the network broadcasting to the users within the cell, so that's downlink only. Although we saw, again, we compared it with uplink so that the users could respond, but the broadcast nature is downlink only. And so we can use this to transmit information that controls the network victim cells, neighboring cells. We have common control channels, which we use for call setup and sort of negotiation between the user and the network. And then we have dedicated control channels, which are used to manage actual connectivity,
including the assignment of our uplink and downlink channel when we're making a connection with the user. Okay. So the traffic channels can carry either speech or data, and the main distinction for traffic channels is just your data rate. And so you can either have, and these data rates again are linked to speech encoding. And so you can have encode at 13 kilobits per second, and plus all of our channel encodings are redundancy to try and deal with errors, and so we'll get 22.8 kilobits per second. If you want to send data, you're limited to that rate. We can also send at speech at half the full rate, so not as good a quality, but a lower rate and possibly better reception quality. Okay. And so what you would think essentially is that you're going to allocate one of these time slots, and the user will then use that for their information. But we also interleave control information onto the same physical channel, so same time slot. We define what's called the 26-frame multi-frame, and so that means for every 26 time slots that go by, you can define positions within that 26 time slots, and indeed, we use frame 12 within that within those 26 slots to transmit control information. So, again, every 26 frames, you can send control information. Okay, so our broadcast channels, again, are being transmitted to users within the cell. And so they always start, it always uses the first frequency in the first time slot and in the downlink direction only. So then the user can find this information. So, a number of operations go in within the broadcast channels. We manage our frequencies. We have a frequency correction channel, and that's transmitted every 10 frames, starting with the first frame. And this allows the mobile station to synchronize with the base station so that they can detect the signals. We have a synchronization channel, again, every 10 frames. It follows after the FCCH. And this allows for time synchronization within the channels. So this is
all the managing the physical aspects of the radio transmission. We then have broadcast control channel, which is frames 2 to 5, which is disseminating other sort of useful information to the users within the cell. So, common control channels then are used to try to set up and negotiate a connection for the user, or resource allocation for the user with the network. And these happen in both uplink and downlink direction. So they're associated with, again, user connectivity, but it's sort of, again, before a link is established and before an actual link is established. Okay, so we have, and again, we divided things up. Into a number of functions. So we start with paging. Paging again occurs in the downlink direction, and it's used for locating our user. The user uses the random access channel in the uplink direction, and it uses this to either respond to a page or potentially to request its own connection. Then we have the access granted channel. So again, this is in response to a user request, and is used to authenticate the user and then to allocate resources to the user. Okay. Okay, so again, the common control channel is sharing physical channels with the broadcast control channel, and it again does this by multiplexing and defining multi-frames. Now we have a cycle of 51 multi-frames, and the various channels are again going to be assigned different frames within that multi-frame to transmit their information. Okay. And so we can look at an example here. We have our first carrier frequency and our first time slot being used, and then different information is being transmitted on that carrier frequency and time slot at different points within the multi-frame. Okay. So again, we have different control information transmitted at different points. So that's sort of information before sort of specific connections are made up. And then we also sort of have control information associated with the specific allocation of resources. Okay, so this these are associated with a specific connection between user and network. So we start with dedicated control channels, and they are now bi-directional, so they're the connection between the user and the network, and they can occur anywhere except on time slot zero on the broadcast control channel, so you can use anything except the broadcast control channels. So again, we're subdividing into a number of sub-channels. So we have our standalone dedicated control channel, and this manages the user identification and resource allocation, and sort of it's control, it's a control channel, a communication channel while you're setting up your link. So this is managing the link, or managing the setup of the link. Then we have our slow associated control channel while the link exists. So once the user's been allocated resources, then this manages the connection and the mobile station for the duration of that allocation. And we also have a fast associated control channel, which is, again, sort of emergency messages, urgent messages that need to be sent. And so, again, on some time slot other than zero, we multiplex the various control channels on. Again, these are now associated with specific users, and so you'll be allocating to more than one user. Okay, so I've gone on longer than usual about this, and let me just see, think about where we are. And okay, so I think we'll actually take a break now, take a deep breath, and there is a bit more to look at in terms of sort of channels and our logical entities, but I think that's sort of the main concepts there. So we'll take a break, and we'll return to this in about 15 minutes.